We're actually in the heart of Manhattan, right near Times Square. My name is Paul Edlund. And for the next hour, I'm going to talk to you guys a little bit about cybersecurity and how not to be hacked. A little bit about, you know, the way I typically present on cybersecurity is, you know, there's a few things that I really try and avoid with you guys. One is I try and avoid fearing you or scaring the heck out of you because I think it's counterproductive. The other thing that I don't do a lot of is give you guys a lot of numbers. As it relates to this topic, it's sometimes hard not to do those things. And so when I'm providing you with some of this detail for the next hour or so, I'm going to try my best not to scare you, but some of this stuff sounds scary. And, you know, as Microsoft people, we tend to focus a lot on products. But there have been two conversations that have kind of been ignored for a while as it relates to these presentations with you. We haven't overly focused on the people side or the process side. And so I also wanted to take a little bit of time to focus with you on those things. So this presentation is less about the tools and more about the people and process. And so with that, let's just kind of drill right in. You know, you've gotten a lot of information of Microsoft over the course of the last few months around security, and I've presented to you once or twice on this topic already. You've seen slides like this over and over and over from cybersecurity folks. You get them all the time. As a matter of fact, I feel like they try and beat you over the head with this slide in order to scare you into action. I'm going to take a slightly different tack on this message, though. If you look at the typical timeline of one of these breaches, you see that, you know, in some cases, that green section may actually be months long, right? That time of period when they're doing reconnaissance and trying to get into your environment. And then the breach happens, and that takes, you know, very little time. Usually that's a light switch worth of time. And then the longer, you know, another long period is how long it takes you to get them out. But what are we doing about this at Microsoft? Really, what is our goal? Our goal is really this. It's to make the early section, that green section, such a pain in the butt for the bad guys that they focus on somebody else. Right? And this is a little bit of Darwinism. It's like you don't have to be the fastest guy. You just have to run faster than the guy next to you. When they get in, which they're inevitably going to do, they're going to get in at some point if they're that persistent. The next thing that you ask us is, Microsoft, how do you make that as short of time as possible? Right? So get them, you know, to have it take a huge amount of time to get in, have it take a really short period of time to help get them out. The things that I'm going to focus on for the remainder of this time today really, though, is those things that we can do up front. The things that we do to get them out are often, you know, they can be complicated because it's a constant game of cat and mouse. So, you know, big ticket items. If you were just asking a consultant, what should I do? These are probably the things that they'll mention to you that you have to do no matter what. Just this is like table stakes. And I'm not going to walk through this list. You guys will have this live. You'll certainly have it on video. If you want to take a screenshot right now, now is a good time. You know, and I think that you're gonna see lists like this. You know, you'll find it other places. But once again, we will provide this to you. If you can't get to it now, you'll be able to get to it later. But those are the things that you kind of have to assume. And some of them, you know, even from the top down, you know, no Java, no Flash. You know, those things are massive entry points for people because they're constantly being attacked because they're prevalent, right? And so, you know, it's those are just some of the things. Like I said, I'm not going to walk through all of these things on this list. I just more so wanted to put it up on the screen so that you knew what table stakes were. As it relates to the larger conversation around cybersecurity and the tools, not so much the tools, but the people and the process side, this conversation that I'm going to have with you today focuses predominantly on the very first bubble here, which is securing privileged access. And so this securing privileged access really is kind of a multi-phase, multi-part discussion, right? And we're going to break this down even further. There is a small subsection around high-value assets in here, but really that's a whole conversation to itself. Then data center security, information protection, and device protection are things that we've kind of covered quite a bit over the course of the last presentations with you. So with that, let's just kind of drive right in. This is your environment. This is going to seem insulting, right? This is your environment. Your world is made up of all of the things that you do within your data centers, your devices, your people, your high-value assets, your administrative environment, et cetera. But there's the thing that's common about all of them is two things. One is that your network is becoming a heck of a lot more porous. It's becoming more porous because people are bringing in strange devices, and also you're using companies like Microsoft or other cloud providers, infrastructure as a service providers, platform as a service providers, or software as a service providers, in order to give your end users and your customers more capabilities. So that environment is much harder to manage when you take into consideration that you've got all these moving pieces. What's common about all of them? What's common about all of them is the fact that you have an identity. That identity spans across those clouds, and this is the new perimeter, really, is the fact that your identities are the one thing that should be common. If it's not common, it actually creates more havoc, because now you've got 15 accounts or 20 accounts or 30 accounts, and it's really not uncommon for me to hear from companies that, yes, we still have 6 or 7 different accounts that we manage to. When you only have one account, you're putting all your eggs in one basket, but conversely, it becomes a lot simpler to figure out what a particular user is doing. And so from a security perspective, there are so many benefits that they generally outweigh the idea of having more accounts. There is one exception to having more accounts, which I'll talk to you guys in a little bit. But, you know, generally speaking, you know, you guys have people who are doing all the right things. And I had a customer who was talking to us recently, and they were saying, well, you would allow your people at Microsoft to go unfettered out into the internet and then, you know, let them bring those devices back in? Well, yeah, because we take a defense in depth perspective or posture on our employees, right? So we don't just treat them as, we know that they have to do their jobs, and in order to do them, they have to be disconnected or connected, et cetera. And they need those tools and resources in order to be able to do them. The thing that is a little bit unique about us Microsoft employees is we tend to not glue things together. We run on our stack, right? But for a company like yours, you could have people who are doing all the right things, but they're going to websites which may have bad things on them, like, you know, and I'm not picking on anybody. Let's just say that there's an advertisement inside of Yahoo, right? And that advertisement has a breach in it. Now that breach has gotten into your network, and just by browsing, those attackers can now get access into your corporate resources. So even though you might be forcing them into your tunnels through VPN, et cetera, now that the attackers gained a foothold just through a user doing something normally, browsing, the bad guys have found a foothold into your environment. And so part of what we have to do as a part of this cat and mouse game is find new ways of protecting our users and specifically our administrators. So, you know, let me just use an example. Once again, I told you that I wasn't going to fear you. We often have many, you know, kind of, we have a lot of things that sound like fear. I'm going to use this one to just give you a sense for how the bad guys get in. You may have heard this one from me before. It's called Death by Kittens. So, by the way, I want to give a quick shout out to our producer here locally, Jen, who's putting this whole thing together for us, and Kevin out in California. I've picked on him before today, but today I'm going to pick on Jen. I know for a fact that Jen is a sucker for videos of cute kittens. I know this about her because I've researched her on LinkedIn and Twitter and Facebook, and Jen talks about how much she loves her job as being a producer of videos and video content, but she also talks about her love for kittens. So what I do is I actually go and I create a very specific attack for Jen that says, hey, Jen, you know, I know you love these videos of cute kittens, and I found this really amazing one. And Jen's like, oh my gosh, I love cute kittens so much. And if she had just looked at that link that I sent her, she would have noticed that I changed the O in YouTube to a 0. But Jen doesn't do that. So what she does is she clicks on this link, and she's sent to a site that looks like YouTube and it feels like YouTube. But instead of it actually being YouTube, it actually it says, before you can watch this video of cute kittens, we need to update your Flash player. And Jen's like, oh my gosh, I love cute kittens. And what does she do? She clicks on that updater, and it doesn't really update Flash. What it does instead is it loads something called a listener. What that listener does is it waits for Jen to launch something else up, like Word or Notepad or Excel, and then it waits for 5 minutes, and then it kills it. And then she launches it, and then it kills it. Well, what does Jen do next? She restarts her computer because she thinks that that'll fix it, but it doesn't help at all. In this case, you know, she launches up something else and it kills it. So what does she do? She calls the help desk and she says, oh my gosh, my computer's acting so strange. I don't know what happened. She doesn't tell them about the kittens because that was way too embarrassing. And they say, hang on a second, Jen will log in remotely. And they log into our machine with some elevated credentials and that listener is waiting. And it takes the user ID and something called the Kerberos hash of her password, and it redirects that to a domain controller, where it uses those credentials to bind to the sysfile or the C drive of that domain controller. And then using a tool called Mimikatz or one of the other crazy tools out there, it enumerates all of those credentials off of the domain controller and onto Jen's local machine. And then what it does is it takes those credentials and it creates, it takes your standard user accounts in the domain and it gives them additional permissions so that if you looked in the domain admins group or the enterprise admins group, you wouldn't see anything. But if you looked at the permissions of those standard users, you would see that they had a whole bunch of extra permissions that gave them the ability to do administrative-like things. And then what it does is it moves them around every 2 or 3 or 5 minutes. And so what you're doing is you're playing whack-a-mole trying to find those accounts. You're killing 5, it creates 10, you kill 10, it creates 20, et cetera. And that job just gets harder and harder over time. Now, all of that is creepy, including Jen's love of kittens, but the thing that makes that somewhat unique is this lateral movement, right? And so why do I tell you about this? Now, attacks come in a lot of different ways, but really there's two things that attacks use. One is elevated credentials, and two is this thing called lateral movement. And lateral movement means moving sideways between your devices. So the sideways part is something that you guys can protect against. As a matter of fact, we have service offerings at Microsoft where we teach you through this program called POPSLAM, or Proactive Operations Program, Securing Lateral Account Movement, which is a terrible acronym, but a very useful service. Now, the thing that I've done for you guys is I've made that public. And so there's an article written by a woman on our team named Jessica Payne, and Jessica teaches you guys how to mitigate against legitimate lateral movement versus illegitimate lateral movement. And this article that I've provided you guys gives you the ability to understand what those events that are driven through lateral movement look like and then be able to secure them. There's an additional tool set underneath there called Windows Event Forwarding, which takes those events that are happening on those local workstations and it pushes them out into a central repository. So as people are using this lateral movement in your environment, you know the events, you see the events, and you can start to trigger things on those, like workflows, for example. You know, now that's just kind of one example here, and I'm gonna go a little bit deeper. Before I do that, the one thing I wanted to mention is that these guys have crazy awesome tools. The bad guys don't just sit around and write scripts. They actually build full programs. And the thing about some of these programs like Metasploit or Mimikatz or others out there is that tool vendors will actually write their tools that work in conjunction with other tools. And so as these tools get smarter, they just kind of keep building. Almost think of it like productivity for bad guys. They keep adding to these resources. And so the older your infrastructure is, the more of these tool sets work. The newer your infrastructure is, the less of these tool sets that actually work. And there's, I've gotten some screenshots here of like Armitage and others that are just kind of, like I said, they're just built-in things that these bad guys use, and they kind of glom them together. So let's get deep for a second. Let's just pretend that your company has been breached. I'm going to give you a 3-step process to start actually forcing their way out. Now, in the event that you're breached, right, you're doing a lot more than this. So what I'd like you to do is pretend that you are breached right now. I'm not saying that, I'm saying that literally, not figuratively. I want you to pretend right now that you're starting to build a program that helps you guys stop against being breached. So let's just pretend that you're breached, but I want you to put yourself into this mindset. The sooner you do this, the better off you'll be. So let's just focus in on the things that you can start doing right now. The first one is starting to secure your critical resources. And once again, I am only focusing on identities here. I am not going to focus in on your high-value assets or your data centers or your devices because that's a completely different topic. But let's just start with your identities because this is the most critical thing that you can do. One is that you want to separate out your administrative tasks from your standard user accounts. If you're using the same account to administer your PCs and your servers that you use to read your email, you need to stop doing that. That is step one for your administrators. Stop doing that craziness because there is no easier way for a bad guy to get in than to have your account breached and be breached and then use all of the details and knowledge that you have in your documentation and all of your access to all your servers and services. There is no easier way for a bad guy to move around. So the first step is to take out those accounts and separate them. So we have specific accounts for administrative tasks. We're going to get further than that, by the way. The second thing that you need to do or start thinking about doing is these things called PAWS. Now, everything inside of Microsoft has an acronym. We have protective administrative workstations. We have secured administrative workstations, which are referred to as DAWs or SAWs. We also have dedicated administrative workstations, DAWs. All of those are the exact same thing. So if you hear a saw, a paw, or a daw, you will know that we're talking about taking machines and isolating them for administrative tasks. And the one thing about isolating them is that you need to do this at a few different layers. And I'm going to show you, I believe, if I don't show you in one of these slides, I will actually talk about this. So step two is creating something called PAWS. So notice that I provide you links under each of these recommended actions. You don't have to figure this stuff out. These aren't products. These are tools and people things that you need to be working on. So one of them is standing up these PAWS. Part three is using unique admin passwords or local, what we call local admin passwords for your workstations. Now let's reverse the clock back to that, you know, that attack where I sent Jen that link of videos of cute kittens and Jen couldn't help herself and she had to click on it. What Jen's account was doing or what that administrator, so if the first thing Jen was doing is I was just infiltrating Jen's computer. But the next thing that happened was when I got that administrator on my machine and then that administrator went sideways with that account. Now, if that account only had rights to my local machine and not to the domain controller, that would have stopped, you know, a chunk of that attack from happening. The issue that we get into with lateral movement is that often people use the same user ID and the same password across all their local workstations. And so if I can infiltrate one, I'm able to jump to another one. Now, if that second one happens to be a user with some domain administrative credentials or enterprise administrative credentials, even worse, now I've gotten into that box and I can use those local admin credentials to put in things like listeners and all kinds of other stuff. And then when you invoke those domain or enterprise administrative credentials, once again, I've gotten you. If I can't jump from a standard user's box to an admin's box, I've actually taken away part of the movement, right? So making what allows us to do that is changing the password between every single one of those workstations. There's a tool that we have called LAPS, the Local Admin Password Toolkit, that actually allows you to do that. So there's the link for it as well. And LAPS, none of these things are products. They're toolkits. You can download them. They're free. Go get them. And by deploying this, it helps you not only administer your local accounts, but also segment all your devices and then be able to reset those passwords. There's a bunch of processes that kick in, but basically this is a large group policy object which lets you randomize and manage these local administrative passwords. Four is that you got to do the same things on your servers. You can't just do this on your workstations and pretend that everything is merry. People get into this, if they can go from your workstations to your servers, or if you get breached at one server, they can use those to jump to a different server. It's the exact same problem. LAPS works perfectly well on servers as well as it does on PCs. So once again, the same toolkit deployed in a slightly different way, right? Now, once you've kind of had those four things done, that was step one, there's a few things that you need to take into consideration. And I'm not going to advocate for one versus the other because each of them has a place. However, I will tell you how we do it in Microsoft land. So the first one is that if you have these protective administrative workstations, like the things over here on the left, you will notice that those are in red. So wherever you see this red color from here on out through this presentation, you'll know that that's a secured administrative workstation. Those workstations are using different things to get to the servers that they need to administer. The first one is using the Microsoft Management Console, the MMC. That's one way to do it. The second one is to go from one of these secured or one of these PAWs to an RDP session on a server. Now, there's actually some benefits to doing the second one versus the first one is that you can specify ranges of IP addresses that can RDP into those boxes. It's a little tougher to do with the MMC access, but with the RDP, you can actually say only respond on these network segments, right? And so it gives you the ability to kind of isolate that a little bit more. And then the third one down is actually the way that we do it in our cloud. So what happens is when, I'm going to give you an example here of just Azure, for example. If you have a ticket that you open up with us because maybe you have a virtual machine inside of Azure that's rebooting or causing you some havoc, you would typically open up a ticket. That ticket gets dropped to a manager. That manager sees all of the tickets that they've been assigned. Underneath all of those tickets are the engineers who help them close tickets. Now, that list of engineers that's below the tickets actually has been pre-screened inside of Azure, and it's all the people who aren't on any no-fly list, any government watch list. They haven't been trade debarred. They're not any of those things. And we rescreen our cloud employees here in the United States every 2 years. Different countries have different rules, but here in the U.S., we rescreen our cloud employees every 2 years. What happens is that any of the people who are left in that list, because it's automated, if they don't complete their training, they just don't show up in the list. Whoever's left in that list, the manager clicks on one or more of their accounts, and what happens is those engineers are issued one-time user IDs and passwords to run a script for a period of minutes. So we don't do console inside of Azure because it doesn't scale. There's just way too much physical and virtual stuff out there for us to do it with console. And it's not repeatable. So what happens next is those engineers are issued those one-time user IDs and passwords to run a script. They log into something called a jump server. That jump server is a dedicated remote gateway. And when they log in, obviously all this traffic is, we have policies that say what's allowed to talk between point A and point B. Within the jump server, it can only talk to these devices via certain ports and protocols and IPsec policies, et cetera. What happens, though, is when an engineer logs into that jump server, they type in their regular user ID and their password, my normal one. And then what happens is my phone rings, and I have to type in a PIN. And then once I've been typed in my PIN, then the user interface progresses. Now what I do is I type in the temporary user ID and password that I was issued, and I run my script. What you guys get back is the success or the failure of the script, the time that it started, the time that it stopped, et cetera, all the way through there. That is the jump server method. That's how that works. And that gives you the greatest amount of control and understanding of where your people are coming in from, what they're able to talk to, what ports and protocols they're able to use. You've kind of filtered it down to the bare minimums. If I see something coming outside of one of those ranges or ports or protocols, you instantly have something to trigger an alert upon. All right, so that's just an example. Step two. In step two, what we do is we take all of the stuff that we did in step one and we assume that it's done. So if you're starting two and you haven't finished one, bad on you, because you're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to do all of one, and now you're on two. So the first thing that we do with now that we have our PAWs is that we actually employ things like credential guard and remote desktop protocol policies and other things that we can do to harden those PAWs even further. And so once again, the cyber PAW link underneath teaches you kind of phase two what to do once you've kind of gotten them stood up. The next thing that we do is we do these things called time-bound privileges, which in the admin world is called just-in-time. So in just-in-time provisioning, what it means is that I don't leave any administrators laying around inside of my domain admins or enterprise admins group. What I do is I provision them in, I leave them in there for so many minutes or so many hours based on what they need to get done, and then I take them out. By time-bounding them, it means that I have to have some stuff in front of that to help us time bound them. And there is there's a few things that we do. There's actually a few products that we use here, if you want to talk about Microsoft, or a few procedures. But by time bounding our users, it gives us that ability to take all the domain admins and enterprise admins out of the credential store. We take them out of those groups, and what we do is we provision them in on the fly. And what we leave behind in those domain admins group or enterprise admin groups are some service accounts and some God accounts, frankly, that we additionally secure down, and nobody ever uses those. And we trigger workflows with those accounts much more heavily, because that means somebody's using a God account. Those are, anyways. But now what we've done is, by time bounding them, we've actually kind of we've taken all the domain admins and enterprise admins out. What happens is there's a few tools here. One is privileged account management, this thing called PAM, which teaches you how to do that with scripted processes. There's also something we do inside of Azure called Azure Protected Identity Manager, or Privileged Identity Management, that allows us to take leave them behind in Azure. On premise, there are tools like Microsoft Identity Manager that you can deploy. You could also start looking at Windows Server 2016 when it ships later on this year or early next year. It will have these capabilities built in, these just-in-time capabilities. Or you could deploy something called a Red Forest, which is a huge pain in the butt. Don't do that. There are also other third-party tools out there as well that allow you to do this just-in-time provisioning. Next is that we have just enough administration. So not only are we provisioning people in on the fly and keeping them there for a very short period of time, we're only giving them the rights to do what they need to do. Just because we're granting them administrative credentials, we're not just giving them the keys to the kingdom, we're allowing them to do the task that we want them to do. So this combination of JIT and JEA, just enough just-in-time provisioning, just enough administration, are the two things that work together. And JEA is something, once again, another link. So we've got, I got some ways to show you how it works. And then lastly, what we need to do is, once we have all of those things in place, and it seems kind of counterintuitive, but at this stage now, because we've secured our accounts, what we can do is further harden our Active Directory environment. And this article, which is a TechNet article around hardening your AD, is a way for you to go deep in through those policies and procedures to further harden Active Directory so that it will only respond to these JIT and JEA tools. It's limited by IPsec policies. This is how we protect our stuff in Microsoft. We employ kind of this defense in depth stance that has a lot of different layers, and we treat each of them individually. Rather than going all the way through the minutiae, you know, of these things, I will say that these articles have a lot of detail, and I just want to encourage you to pull them out. Lastly is when somebody deviates from the norm, what we also have is Advanced Threat Analytics, which is a product that helps you guys understand when somebody's doing something odd. And so what ATA does is you plug it into your network and it starts to watch how your users do their jobs. And it will understand that maybe you have a call center group of people, and those call center folks, they come in at 7 in the morning, they do these 4 or 5 things, they open up these 6 or 7 applications, and then they leave at 3 p.m. And now they're coming in at 10 p.m. and they're doing a bunch of things that they never do. Something like Advanced Threat Analytics looks against the way that they typically do their work versus what's happening now and says, wow, that's kind of odd. That user never did that before. And we build a model in Advanced Threat Analytics for every user in your environment. So ATA is a great tool. I told you I wasn't going to talk much about the tools, but I do want to give this one a quick shout out around Advanced Threat Analytics, because it does take some of these items 1 through 4 here, or 1 through 5, and add additional product capabilities on top. All right. So as it relates to these PAWs, I wanted to give you a little bit more detail on the protective administrative workstations. The first one is that, you know, these are a few different scenarios. All of them assume that the device that's being run upon is secured. We wouldn't reverse these things out and put something really secure on an insecure device. Okay, I think that should make sense. But so the first one here is that we will use, in order to do PAWs, is we physically separate out the administrative workstations from the non-administrative workstations. So you will never do an administrative task on a non-administrative piece of hardware. okay? I think that that should make sense. So in this little diagram that I've got up here, two boxes. One that you use to do all your craziness of everything else that you do for your job, and a separate box for administrative stuff. Physically separate, a completely different desktop or laptop. Two is that you can use virtual machines. Once again, the physical thing is always the most secure. So what we have in this case is we have a virtual machine where you have a physical machine where we're using it to connect up to a remote desktop protocol, an RDP session or remote desktop protocol session, in old school, like terminal server kind of stuff. But the physical device is always hardened. And then what we'll do, and that physical device is what we would also use, that physically hardened device is also what we're using to connect to our remote desktop for my collaboration stuff. So I'm not, I might use, or even the other way that this could be drawn is that I might be using the red box to do my MMC work, my Microsoft Management Console work, and then I'm using RDP to do my day-to-day reading email, browsing the web kind of stuff. But once again, the physical box is hardened. Now on the VM side, on the physical VM side, on the virtual machine side, we have the exact same concept, except that now I'm doing, I have my administrative tasks in the A, which is on the physical hardware, and I use a VM for my user-based tasks in order to read my email. But once again, the physical device is the most hardened thing. We wouldn't flip this one in particular. You wouldn't put the administrative stuff on an unhardened physical machine. I hope that that makes sense. And then lastly, we have this thing called Windows to Go. Awesome. This one actually does allow you to kind of mix them, but mostly because when we do Windows to Go, you're abstracted from the physical hardware. There's a way that we have to do this within policies to make sure that the Windows to Go can only do certain things on the physical hardware. So there is some procedure in here as well. But you take that Windows to Go stick, and what we do is we put a secure VM on here, and then we plug it into a piece of hardware. Once again, we limit some of the things that it can do on that physical hardware. That's an important step. But now that VM is able to do its administrative tasks. But once again, the physical operating system actually lives, the OS lives on that thumb drive. And this is kind of some scenarios that get lit up by this thing. And so, if you have high impact roles or, et cetera, this is what I once had a job inside of the government, and they had physically separated networks for different types of secured traffic. This is exactly what they employed, completely air-gapped hardware on different network segments. Good way to administer stuff, the most secure way. Versus, the second and third ones, which, they're kind of written out here. I don't need to go through this. All right, step three. You've accomplished steps one and two. We're now on to three. You're almost there. Once again, step three assumes that we've kind of done all of the stuff in step two and one, so you're starting there. Now, the next thing is that we're going to kind of modernize all of our roles and create a delegation model. This is... It's really more about, and this is somewhat consultative, it's in that you need ways to build workflows around those JIT and JEA capabilities. And in many cases, those represent very complex processes for your businesses. And so our enterprise cybersecurity group actually fills a void there. But that helps you guys build policies and procedures around the things that you did in step one and two. I'm hopeful that at some point we will actually give you a more detailed document that outlines those things, but today not so much. Step two is that we can do smart card or passport authentication, and smart card and passport let me just call out the smart cards. So all employees at Microsoft, we have a smart card, and it's got a chip in it, and this is what we use in order to secure certain things, like if I have to do a VPN in some cases, we may need our smart cards in order and have to plug them in. We will use virtual smart cards in as well, which kind of leverage the TPM capabilities of your hardware. All of them, I personally don't know of any that don't require a trusted platform module, a TPM chip on your physical PC. There might be some weird vendor out there who does something that I'm not aware of, but they have to work in conjunction with your hardware. Passport is where we take the idea of something like your face or your iris or your thumbprint or long phrases or PIN codes, and we store them on the trusted platform module, the TPM chip of your PC as well. And then what we do is we light those up with additional capabilities, which I'll talk about in a second. Administrative forest for Active Directory administrators, this is actually that red forest that I talked to you guys about a little while ago. This is really high-end kind of stuff. When you're talking about red forest, typically people would do a red forest because you've been breached. To do a red forest for not being breached is something where, once again, a really high-level function, but it requires quite a bit of rigor. And so I would say if you want to get crazy, mad black belt skill on security, looking at a red forest is a way to be kind of at the pinnacle of that. But basically what you're doing is you're creating a completely isolated domain specifically for administration. Let me just kind of finish that statement about why we would do it in the event that you were breached. It's specifically because it's your only way to attest that you've gotten all of the bad guys out. Because of that whack-a-mole game that we were playing with the pass the hash attack, which was really the death by kittens thing that I did with Jen earlier, because of that, sometimes you're not quite sure. You feel like you're mostly confident, but something might wake up in hours, days, weeks, months. And so what we need to do in order to make sure that we've gotten it all out is we employ this thing called a red forest. That's this administrative forest for Active Directory administrators, this ESAA thing. And this is a way for you to assure that you've gotten the bad guys out, because basically what we do is we take your existing domain, we leave it alone, we build a new domain next to it, we create new accounts for all of your users. In the old domain I was Paul E, in this new domain I'm P. Edland. And then what we do is we migrate something called the SID history off of the old domain, and then we have the credentials or the ACLs from your old domain, and then we burn down the old domain. And we take all the credentials out. Now, in doing so, I used to be Paul E. over here. Now I'm P. Edlin in this new domain. And if a piece of malware wakes up in hours, days, weeks, months, it has no context to ride in. That's the reason why we have this red forest design. So really great stuff. Really not easy to deploy because you have so much ingrained in your existing domains, too. You have backup accounts and service accounts. But in some cases, like financial services, this is pretty much, you know, this is the rigor that they have to employ. Code integrity policies for domain controllers is where we're basically code signing all of the things that are allowed to run on a DC. So if something gets onto a domain controller that's not code signed, it doesn't run. On Windows devices, think of this as something called device guard, which is a way for us to not only whitelist and blacklist applications, but we also secure them with a secure certificate that says these certificate-based applications are allowed to run. And if the certificate doesn't show up, this piece of code just won't execute. And there's a way for you to self-sign your existing applications. So this is actually something that's, it's a process. I wouldn't say that this is as hard as the Red Forest. The Red Forest is a lot more work. This is something that you guys can certainly do, and there's tools that help you guys do this, especially as a part of Windows Server 2016. This is both a Windows thing, a Windows 10 thing, as well as a Windows Server 2016 thing. This is not something that you could have done on your 2012 R2 or 2008 domain controllers or servers, or your Windows 7 or Windows 8 machines. This is a new thing. And then lastly is these things called shielded VMs for virtual domain controllers. In order for us to protect against insiders, like administrative attacks, we actually have to remove, and this could be advertent or inadvertent. I don't mean to sound like your admins are doing bad things. Sometimes they're doing inadvertent things, which put you at risk, and sometimes they're doing very sneaky things to put you at risk. I mean, in the case of like Edward Snowden, you could have called that an insider attack in a sense. But the idea around shielded VMs is that we take the virtual machine file and we isolate it from the guy who actually runs the VM infrastructure, so that the guy who's running the infrastructure can't read inside the virtual machine. And so this allows us to segment the data from essentially in the old world, this would say like my server people who stand up my servers have no login rights to my physical servers. This is the same thing within virtual machine land, right? So by shielding these VMs from the running of the VM from the actual guts of the VM, we actually take away some of their ACLs, and in doing so, we put this burden now onto the business unit. So the business unit's responsible for the data, and the administrator of the server or the VM infrastructure is responsible for configuring and managing the VMs. All right, so the one thing I alluded to very early on in this presentation was this concept of high value assets, which I told you that I wasn't going to go through, but on one of the slides, the big three things or the big things, the big ticket items that you can do, one of them is that it said you should separate that out the tiers of your investments. So in terms of these tiers, we have three, tier zero, tier one, and tier two, because as IT people, we can never start at one. We always have to start at zero. So in terms of our tier zero stuff, think of those as domain controllers. As tier one might be all of the places where data or services live, so think file servers, application servers, et cetera, you know, database servers. And then tier two are your access boxes, like your workstations or your maybe, you know, things that are accessing the actual data. Just really, you know, this should make sense. Now that I've told you all of these things about these protective administrative workstations, is not only should you be segmenting out your administrative tasks from your non-administrative tasks and separating the kind of the user accounts and the hardware and all of that other stuff, you also should be doing this per tier. So never should you have a tier one administrative account talking to a tier zero service. In doing so, if you employ these things and somebody breaches one of your servers, they're not getting into your credential stores or they're not getting into your Active Directory boxes. If somebody breaches a workstation, they have no ability to get into a zone. So in other words, not only can we not go laterally, we can't go vertically between these services as administrators. That's a way to think of it. We want to secure against the lateral movement. We also want to secure against the vertical movement up through the stack. And so these isolating administrative tasks to these tiers is a way for us to do that. And never should something from a tier zero be talking down to a tier one, because as we move from tier zero to tier two, things inherently get less secure, inherently. So we never really want to talk across any of these tiers. We want to isolate it as much as possible. And then if you see something trying to communicate from, you know, in a tier zero that's really a tier one account, you've got your trigger. So this is also a way for you to play cat and mouse with your bad guys. Think of these not only as recommendations, but also think of them as ways that you can track down the badness when it starts to breach into your network. Assuming that we're all going to get breached, we need mechanisms for triggers, and this is one of those mechanisms. All right. Next, I want to talk to you guys briefly, just really briefly in the sense that around this idea of documentation versus automation. The problem with documenting your administrative processes is as soon as something changes, if you don't update the document, it becomes instantly stale. And then the problem is that you're going back and leveraging a document that no longer represents the administrative control that you're trying to put in place. So by building tools around automating things instead of documenting things, you've kind of you've documented by automating. And this is a really great process thing to do. This is also the reason why almost all of the Microsoft tool sets like System Center or Exchange or Active Directory, the last step in the wizard is it spits out a PowerShell script. What we want you to do with those PowerShell scripts is take them and drop them into things like Orchestrator, which is a System Center tool, and then take those and build workflows out of those procedures and just create variables out of the things like the user account field, for example, or the password field. We want you to create variables there. Now you can take these really complex processes and never do them manually. Because every time you do something manual, it kind of introduces vulnerability. It also introduces inconsistency. So then if you're not going to do documentation via automation, the next thing that you have to have in place is something that measures desired configuration state, which is a part of Configuration Manager, by the way. But this desired configuration state allows you to manage something called drift. So when something is drifted away from your process, you understand what's drifted. So do them both. Automate and measure drift. Now you're knowing if administrators are doing non-administrative tasks in a administrative tasks in a non-automated way. And try and minimize the amount of non-automated things that you do in your environment. All right. I actually used this already, this example here, so I'm actually going to skip this slide because I told you about this one earlier in terms of the JIT and JEA capabilities. But this is basically a slide that I used to describe JIT and JEA. Actually, Jen, you can put the slide back up here for me really quickly. There's two links on the bottom here, this JIT demo and this JEA link, which you also saw earlier. The JIT demo link here is the one that allows you to see how we do this in Windows Server 2016. So this is actually a link to a video, and it shows you how JIT and JEA work inside of the server operating system. Great stuff. I kind of flew past it earlier, but I still want to call out that video because it's worth your view. This is something that talks about that administrative forest for administrators. Once again, I wanted you guys to be able to kind of have something visual. This is that ESAE thing that I told you about a little bit earlier, the red forest design. And what this basically says is that, you know, when you create that domain specifically for isolated controls, this is all it can talk to. It shouldn't be talking to the tier zero the tier one or tier two stuff. It also would not be a Microsoft presentation if I didn't give you a bunch of the products that kind of help augment this conversation. So we talked to you a little bit about advanced threat analytics. Operations Management Suite is a way for you guys to take the things that we do in System Center on-premise and move it up to the cloud. So what Operations Management Suite allows you to do is manage across your Microsoft investments with Hyper-V and Azure, as well as your Amazon investments, your OpenStack investments, your VMware investments, and provide you with a single pane of glass. Think about that. Probably the second or third slide that I showed you a long time ago, where I said this is your new, you know, your identity is your perimeter, but you still have to deal with this whole ecosystem of stuff. Operations Management Suite is what allows you to kind of create an umbrella around all of those things that are in your environment and give you a holistic view. One of the big components of that is that orchestration thing, which I just got done telling you about. So think orchestrator in the cloud via OMS, as well as the desired configuration management and the operations management that lets you see these events as they're popping up. As it relates to Windows 10 and Windows Server 2016, for some of this, Credential Guard. We have this capability inside of Windows 10, which virtualizes the local security authority. And this helps mitigate against pass-the-hash attacks. I'm not going to say that it eliminates them because this is, once again, a cat and mouse game. We're always upping our game against the bad guys. Windows 7 and Windows 8 and OS X, and, you know, none of those things make you any more secure just because I'm going to keep Windows 7 around. No, this is part of that cat and mouse that we're playing, which is we're going to virtualize the LS, the local security authority, which is the way that pass the hash attacks show up. There's no memory space to interrogate with Mimikatz in the case of the solution. So this helps greatly reduce the footprint of, or the attack vector, the surface attack vector of a pass the hash attack. Windows Hello and Windows Passport work in conjunction with each other. Passport is, like I said, where we store your thumb, your iris, your facial detection. Windows Hello is the new sensors that show up in hardware like this, where now we have, you know, infrared and depth and webcam images that pick up my face or my thumbprint or my iris. And when we send when we log in across the network, we're never passing our password. So by taking the hash of the password off of the wire, there's nothing to sniff. Instead, what we send across the wired or the wireless connection is something called a NONCE, an N-O-N-C-E, a one-time negotiation between this piece of hardware and whatever I'm communicating with. If there was something sitting on the wire trying to sniff off that NONCE, I don't care. It's a different NONCE the next time I log in, right? Windows Defender ATP looks for anomalous traffic at your workstation level. So we watch across devices and across users. And now what we're doing with Windows Defender ATP is building a model around how people do their jobs. And when we see things deviating from that model, we will show you the attacker that's trying to breach into you. In Microsoft, this is actually really cool. In Microsoft, we identify those attackers by elements on the periodic table. And so for every attacker that we find, there's like an iron, there's a strontium, and there's a there's lead, there's copper, for example. That's how we find them. This thing called Windows Defender ATP is how we show you when we see one of those bad guys is breaching through your network, and especially if we've identified them as a persistent adversary, we show you how those persistent adversaries are traversing through your network. Azure Active Directory and Active Directory Premium and the Active Azure Security Center are how we watch all that traffic in the cloud, and when we find people doing something strange in the cloud, we will actually show it to you in the Security Center. So we have this thing called the Security Graph, which is this layer of machine learning living under all of our cloud services. This is like the thing that watches for those anomalies in our cloud. We also feed that into things like Advanced Threat Analytics and OMS and other places. So think of it as an API, but the Security Center is kind of the visualization aspect of that. So we show you the anomalies coming through the Security Center. Privileged Identity Management, I already talked to. And Customer Lockbox is a way for you to take some of those workflows that represent your business, and now as you're making administrative changes in Office 365, we send a request back to your environment to say, is this really allowed? And then as a part of your workflow, you approve it, and when we ship it back, we send it on to make the change. This just puts another step in front of the bad guys before they can make configuration changes to your tenant within Office 365 or Azure. And Lockbox is specific to Office 365 today, but soon for Azure as well. I'm not making any product announcements there, but we know it's coming. So with that, I think what we're going to do is we're going to open this up to questions and answers. And so I'm going to be joined here by someone named Kat from our team here in the New York MTC, and we're going to see if we've got some questions here.
Got a few questions from the folks in the audience.
Yeah, thanks.
The first one I'm going to start with is, if you could highlight one process, platform, or service that is most imperative to mitigating security threats, what would it be? Or what kind of behavioral adjustments would be most important to make when considering security mitigation?
So I think the question that you're asking is, what's the most critical thing to just getting started?
What do you want to start with?
Where do you start? And in that three-step process, it was the first thing that I called out, which is really the very first step in that whole thing is segmenting off your administrative tasks from your users, from your regular user accounts. So too often what we see happening is people commingling those things. They'll take their administrative tasks, and they'll use their same accounts to do that they use to browse email, and they use those same accounts to get into their domain controllers. That just makes it so easy for the bad guys to get in. And so that would be the very first step that I would take. I would argue, actually, that whole first step section, which now you can rewind this video and you'll be able to see what I was talking about. That whole first section with the securing account, segmenting off your administrative accounts, creating these protective administrative workstations, the PAW things, and then using password randomization, that LAPS tool, the local admin password tool, are really the most critical, and that's the steps to getting started. And those are the things. Also, probably the third slide that I showed you in my deck had the big ticket items. Those are kind of the things that everybody has to do. You have to kind of patch your systems, keep them updated, et cetera, et cetera. So I would just kind of rewind the clock and look back at those slides and take the first step.
That's great. Thanks, Paul. Here's another one. When assessing the security platform, are a lot of these processes happening in the background, or do we need to opt in and constantly enable or monitor them?
Say it one more time. So, Kat, one more time?
Are all the processes happening in the background, or do we need to opt into different processes and monitor them in the background?
Okay, so I'm not sure I fully understand that question, but I'll take a shot, and we'll see if somebody posts a follow-up to that as well. But the things that the various tools are doing, right, this is about the people, tools, and processes, but I focus more on the people and the process side today. So the tools, when you configure these things, there were a lot of links in there. The tools will tell you how to do the process work, essentially, and they'll give you some of the toolkits. The thing that we don't represent very well is your business process, right? And so there's often a business process boiled in there someplace because company A may not do things exactly the same as company B. And so the triggers for company A may be different than company B's. And so within the tools, especially if they spit out events to the event viewer, those are easy ways for things like operations manager to pick up. And then what you will do is then build processes that understand what those things look like normally. And when you see something deviating from the normal, that's when you have your trigger. So the tool gives you the capability. The events that they create tell you when they're happening. And then when they deviate, you have something to pick up.
That's great. You know what? This next one, I think the person was asking more around advanced threat protection.
Sure.
And predictive analytics. Do they ever misperceive user-oriented threats causing lockouts to credentialed users that are false positives? And if so, how would that be resolved by an admin?
Yeah, so in the case of advanced threat, if the question is specifically around advanced threat protection, ATP today doesn't take action. It just tells you that the threat exists. And so once again, what would occur, and the same thing with ATA, Advanced Threat Analytics, what they do is they're really data forensics tools. They may tell you things are happening, but they're not like virus signatures where when we find a file that's been what we think is compromised, that we lock you out of it, or does it get quarantined? In this case, what we would create is the trigger for an event that had happened, but the workflow that gets kicked off behind the scenes would very much represent your business, not ours, because we may not know what to do when an anomaly happens. We might have a recommended best practice, like I would pause this user or I would disable this account. But ultimately, what we should be doing is kicking off to a workflow that represents your business. Once again, I think that there's another big picture, that they're not really asking, but I'm going to answer anyways, which is that Microsoft doesn't assume that we're the center of your security universe. We kind of assume that we're a part of an ecosystem. We're not an island. And so in doing so, we also don't assume that you have System Center. We don't assume that you may have Orchestrator or Operations Manager, data, whatever. We have to be kind of pluggable. And so in that sense, what we need to do is, in some cases, we will automate through our toolkits. But if you don't have the toolkit, we need to give you ways to automate, even if you don't have them. So I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that did. Thank you. So here's another one. I like toolkits like LAPS that help to automate and simplify password management between PCs and servers across an org. But the process still feels cumbersome. Is there a more fully automated way to simplify password management?
Yeah, so that's actually a really good observation and something that I do agree with. I mean, once again, you called it out. It's a toolkit. How do we make it flexible enough where everybody can deploy it, yet kind of stringent enough where it's doing good without causing harm? And so the real thing that, once again, I sound like a broken record at this point, but really I think that the most important technology that rides behind some of these things, like LAPS even, is workflow. And I think one of the places where we see a lot of our bigger customers amping up on some of their skills is that you used to have people who just administered Exchange, right? And they did it all by running through management consoles or web-based consoles, et cetera. What we see a lot of those companies doing is transitioning to orchestrators. And instead of being responsible for Exchange, you're responsible for the collaboration workflows, and those collaboration workflows kind of kick in. In the same sense that what we see in the security realm is people focusing less on the firewall management and more on the business workflows that represent risk and then the automation around those risks that come in. And so it's a higher level of function. People often say to Microsoft, like, well, what if I deploy this tool? You're going to make me fire my people because they're not needed anymore. Hell no. What they do is we elevate their roles into doing higher level functions. And instead of managing a console now, you're managing a process.
Excellent job. Thank you so much
Thanks.
For your How Not to Get Hacked. I want to thank all of those in the audience who have joined us for Q&A and through the session. See you next time.
Thank you.